Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 129 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Cebulski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. When it comes to retelling or reimagining the most exciting bits of history and popular culture, there's one word that gets thrown around a whole lot: treason. Traitors in medieval Europe were the ones who suffered the most grisly executions and the ones whose names became notorious in their own time and in the centuries since. What's easy to forget, however, is that treason is very much in the eye of the beholder and that it changes over time, mixed up as it is in things like culture, language, and ideas of nation. This week, I spoke with Dr. Amanda McVitie about treason in the Middle Ages. Amanda is a lecturer in history at Massey University in New Zealand, where her research focuses on gender in legal and political culture in late medieval England and France. She's written many articles on treason and now has a new book out called Treason and Masculinity in Medieval England: Gender, Law, and Political Culture. Here's our conversation about treason, the law, and how social shifts regarding gender and language can shape the fate of a traitor. Well, thank you, Amanda, for joining me to talk about treason and masculinity. It's a pleasure to have you on the podcast.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
So I think when people think about the Middle Ages, they think about this as being like a super violent time. And one of the things that perhaps gives that impression is some of the execution methods for treason. So when we talk about treason in the Middle Ages, what are we talking about as a legal category? Now, this is a big question because you get into this throughout the book. But where should we start when we think about treason in the Middle Ages?
Well, I think in terms of people coming to this from a non-specialist perspective, perhaps some of the most familiar images of treason we have in the Middle Ages are things like the execution of William Wallace in the film Braveheart, which somewhat inaccurate, but that kind of idea where you have an idea of kings being able to declare anyone a traitor and just execute them without any real due process or anything like that. The period where we get into the sort of late 13th, 14th century is quite an interesting time in terms of the development of concepts of treason, because you do have multiple different ideas about treason that are operating. One of the other really familiar contexts people might know is the theme of treason that comes up a lot in sort of medieval romance literature. So the Arthurian stories, the idea of Lancelot betraying King Arthur by having an affair with Guinevere, and that sort of much more intimate kind of treason between men who are supposed to be best friends and chivalric companions, as well as a king and his loyal subject, and then that bond breaking down. So that more cultural idea of treason. Now, all of those kinds of ideas of treason are in operation in that later medieval period, which is why I think it is quite an interesting time to look at it as a concept. I mean, treason in the bigger sense as a political and constitutional idea, I think, is really interesting. It's obviously still very relevant in society today when you get accusations of treason coming up in contexts like US politics, with the sort of back and forth between Trump and his supporters and the other side, and, you know, your coup on the 6th of January and so on. So that discourse of treason is very much there. And it was I really noticed it as the Brexit debate played out, these ideas of people who were against Brexit being enemies of the people and so on. So it's a very potent cultural idea as well as being a legal category. But in the later medieval period, what we see is there's different ways of treating treason in a political sense. There is as yet no formal statute of treason until the middle of the 14th century. That's the first formal piece of legislation that tries to define treason. And in a way, that was a response to the fact that treason had been such an expansive category, and the people were at risk of being accused of treason for things that wouldn't normally be seen as treason. You know, you've got the obvious kinds of treason, like trying to wage a rebellion against your lord or your king, or trying to murder him, those kinds of things. But, you know, treason had expanded to include a lot of other more nebulous crimes. So we get that 1352, the Great Statute of Treasons comes out, and this tries to define treason according to it, a number of different categories. And amongst those are things that we would think are obviously treason, you know, trying to kill the king or raising rebellion against him in his own lands, fomenting plots against him and so on. But there are also things like having sexual intercourse with the queen or the king's oldest daughter or the wife of his oldest son. So that sense of treason is a much more intimate and personal crime that takes place within the king's household. And that is where you get a much greater sense of treason being not just a legal category, but a cultural breaking of bonds between men. And these sort of what we talk about as homosocial relationships that held medieval political society together being broken because one man has betrayed that relationship. And the idea that comes out very strongly in both legal contexts and in broader cultural reflections of treason and literature and so on is the idea of the traitor as the opposite or the inversion of the true man, or especially the true knight. So all these values that were attached to ideal knighthood, like honor and loyalty and knightly brotherhood, the traitor sort of embodies the exact opposite of all those ideals.
Your book is called Treason and Masculinity specifically. So how does masculinity play into it? Why are you digging into it as a gendered construct in terms of your book?
Well, gender, because we have this situation where in the late medieval context or in the medieval context, the idea that the body politic is a male body, I mean, the body politic is imagined as a body with the king as its head and his male counselors and nobles and, you know, down to the sort of legs and feet of laborers and so on as forming the body, so that the king both embodies and represents the body politic, and that kind of gives it a very masculine sense. And the fact that women, although women could wield power in various ways, especially women of higher status, queens and noblewomen and so on, there was no real formal place for them. Like, they couldn't go to parliament as MPs, they couldn't hold government offices and so on. So the administration of government was very much done through largely personal and familial and relationships of affinity between men. And when I began looking at treason trials, I really noticed that this idea of breaking of bonds between men, bonds that were forged by verbal oaths often, although you would have increasingly written documents that were sort of secondary witnesses to those oaths, but the verbal oath between men was the fundamental, both political and personal relationship that allowed the state to function, that allowed royal government to function. So the way that treason is imagined and the way that it's talked about in the legal documents and everything is very much about the breaking of bonds specifically between men. This is why you may want to talk about this a bit later, but this is why when I found women who were caught up in treason plots, they were often sidelined, and it was the men who were actually tried and convicted of treason, so male accomplices and so on. So it was almost like, because women were not seen as having any formal political agency, they were conceptually incapable of committing the political crime of treason.
Yeah, absolutely.
Does that make sense?
Yes. Well, I think it will make sense the more we throw in some examples. So let's give this a historical moment. Most of your book takes place looking at trial records for treason between the reign of Richard II and Henry V in England. So why did you pick this moment? I think this is a great moment for illustrating how treason and its laws changed over a course of about 40 years. But why did you choose this moment?
Initially, I was really drawn to, I had had some contact with the records of the so-called Merciless Parliament during the earlier part of Richard's reign, where, you know, a number of his inner circle were accused of treason and executed and so on. And it was really, as I started to look more closely at that period, whenever you get periods of a lot of political instability and uncertainty about who holds power, who should be holding power, whether the people who are holding power are the right people to be wielding power, those are the kinds of contexts where we start to get these anxieties bubbling up about loyalty and its opposite side of treason. And so that whole period, because you have, you know, quite a bit of political instability through that period, Richard coming to the throne as a minor, but even by the merciless parliament in 1388, he is a mature man. He's still being talked about by a lot of the nobility as a boy who is not fully capable of ruling in his own right. So he's being manipulated by these other men around him who are always talked about in terms of being evil counselors or wicked advisors, which is a very typical trope in medieval political critique. But this idea that he has this sort of inner circle around him who has separated him from the nobles and the other men who are his true counselors and his true noble, you know, the upright men who should be in that inner circle of government and making the decisions and advising the king, have been gradually shut out. And so there's a lot of instability in that period. And then as we get further into Richard's reign, he has quite a few problems in the 1390s with some of, you know, his relationships with a lot of the political community are really breaking down for various reasons. The financial stresses that the crown's under, various sort of military and political decisions and so on that are being made, has basically just created a lot of stress between the king and these men that are perceived as his inner circle and the larger political community. And then this sort of leads to Richard's deposition in 1399, which is this major political fracture where obviously you have a lot of fear and anxiety and uncertainty, even about how this process of deposing a king and replacing him with someone else could actually even work. You know, how you could separate the body of the king from the body politic of the crown when they had been joined through this, what was really a sacred ritual of coronation that God had made this person king. How could men remove that quality of kingship from him? So this whole period, because then you get a new, you get Henry IV coming in, Henry Bolingbroke as he was, who becomes Henry IV, has some blood legitimacy because he does also descend from Edward III, but is not necessarily the closest blood claimant. And when Henry comes to the throne, the way he presents himself is basically he is, in a sense, the best man for the, you know, he is the best person for the common good of the realm. And so he, although he claims the crown, he has to do a lot of work to kind of continually prove his legitimacy and to claim that sovereignty. And that's in a period where then this triggers a whole lot of treason plots and rebellions and so on, because there's plenty of opportunity now to say, well, I am not a traitor. I am rebelling on behalf of the true king who you've deposed. So, or, you know, either the true king that you've deposed or this other claimant who was, should have been first in line. So I think that's why that period is so interesting, because there is so much political instability that treason just runs throughout that whole period as a constant kind of backstory almost. A few years that might be fairly quiet, and then all of a sudden there's a big outburst of new cases or new fears about treason. So we get quite a lot of new pieces of treason legislation coming out through that period as well that are trying to define the crime more closely, and in some cases expanding it, and then under a new ruler retracting those expansions again, sort of revoking earlier expansions. So it's a really interesting time to study it, because it is such an enormous political concern and also a real cultural concern more widely in society.
Yes, definitely. And I think this moment of deposition where Henry IV usurps the crown is a great place where we can dig into how masculinity is used to justify Henry's taking the throne. and to throw around accusations of treason. So how is masculinity used at that moment? Because I think that's a pretty critical moment for bringing together culture in terms of chivalry and masculinity and using it as a weapon against, well, a king, an anointed king.
Well, there is a lot of discourse that's going on, especially between 1397, when Richard Holles basically calls a parliament that comes to be known as the Revenge Parliament. Mm-hmm. Bit of a spoiler alert as to what happens there. But in this parliament, he basically convicts or has convicted of treason through a fairly trumped up legal process a number of senior noblemen, including his own uncle, the Duke of Gloucester. So he has them convicted of treason and either executed, or in the Duke of Gloucester's case, he had been taken from his home to the royal palace at Calais in France, where he was murdered. It comes out later that he was smothered to death with a feather bed, basically on Richard's orders. So, you know, Richard had been dispatching all these men, and this was seen very much as evidence of tyranny. And tyranny was seen as, in a sense, a gendered quality, because it was the loss of adult masculine reason that people should be able to expect in their kings. There is an opposite way to look at that, and seeing, you know, Richard's taking of righteous vengeance against men who had wronged him and insulted his honor, and that for him to do that was him exerting his own masculinity and manhood. But, you know, the dominant narrative around Richard's deposition was that Richard had proven he was basically talked about, even though he was the same age as Henry Bolingbroke, as being a youth. So being still prone to unreason and not being fully capable of governing well and wisely and with prudence for the public good. So Henry Bolingbroke, or Henry IV, is then positioned against Richard II as a man, not a boy. And this sort of discourse really comes through. And Henry, you know, makes a speech to Parliament when he is going through the process of taking the throne, sort of talking about himself as a man who has come to essentially save England, you know, so almost positioning himself in a way as a kind of chivalric hero who will rescue the country. And even the way that the messages that he's putting out through the process of this few months, where he goes from invading England. Initially, he says this is purely to claim back his right, his inheritance, which has been wrongfully seized from him, taken from him by Richard II. So defending his manly honor and the honor of his family. And, you know, and this is a very common theme in chivalric literature. It would have been quite familiar to people at that time, of the wronged hero who returns and is restored to his lands and his rights and so on. And Henry was also able to draw on, he did have quite a reputation. He had been overseas on crusade and so on. So he had this sort of much more martial and military reputation he could draw on, and really to portray himself as both an ideal king, but also an ideal man, because he embodies all these qualities of adult chivalric knighthood that were the sort of the manly ideal really for kings in this period. Yeah, so that comes through quite strongly in that process of deposition. Yeah.
It helps too that Henry has children and Richard famously does not have children, and that's thrown in his face as well, I think, at that moment.
Yeah, definitely that, you know, Richard hasn't, in some ways, has not proven himself, has not fulfilled this function of providing heirs, male heirs for the throne. Yeah.
This is a fine line for Henry IV to have to walk, though, because part of his credentials for being the manliest man, the best king, are in keeping to his oaths, making promises and keeping them. And I think that's an important thing that maybe we don't always think about when we think about the Middle Ages, is that people pay homage to a king. They say that they will serve the king, but the king is also meant to serve the people. That is a very important part of the function and part of the oaths that they swear to each other. So when Henry IV starts to reign, he starts to be accused of being an oath breaker. And how does that affect his rule as king?
These are some of the most interesting sort of trial records I looked at, actually, because although Henry's accession to the throne was portrayed as this wonderful moment of where England was saved from this dreadful tyrant, it was a very short honeymoon period. And very soon, within a couple of years, or perhaps even less, there was basically a lot of talk and rumors going around about, well, first of all, Richard's supporters accused Henry of having unjustifiably usurped the throne, and they tried to raise a rebellion to restore Richard. During that period, Richard did die in prison, whether he was deliberately murdered or died by natural means is somewhat open to debate. But nevertheless, the rumors very quickly started to circulate that Henry had murdered him. And so, you know, Henry was being accused of being a murderer. There were stories going around that he had sworn when he came to England that he would not take the throne, but he had broken that oath. But more significantly, or more widely spread in the sort of popular realm amongst ordinary people, was where Henry had taken the coronation oath to rule wisely and not to overtax his people and so on. But, you know, by 1401, 1402, he's got a rebellion in Wales to deal with. The crown's finances are not in a great state, and he is taxing the people. And there are complaints that he's collecting all these taxes, but he's not using them properly. He's using them to fund a lavish household instead of using them for military defense and things like that. So this is where you get a series of treason cases where, rather than being these very high-ranking men who are perceived as being too close to the king, so nobility and so on, this is the opposite end of the social scale. It's ordinary artisans and, you know, in one case, a wandering vagabond who's been going around various towns saying that Henry is not the true king, and yes, that he was the son of a butcher of Ghent, you know, and not actually the son of the Duke of Lancaster. So all these kind of salacious stories are starting to go around. But, you know, more crucially are these accounts that he had broken his oath and seized the throne, and that he was a tyrant and not ruling as a good king, and therefore, you know, people should be kind of rising up against him. And this is the period where you also start to see, within a couple of, you know, two, 3 or 4 years of Richard's death, there are rumors circulating that he's actually still alive and he's been off in Wales or Scotland or some other, you know, faraway place, but he's about to return at any moment with his army and reclaim his throne, and all his loyal subjects should be ready to rise up to support him. So, you know, Henry's taking the throne, but also taking on a lot of existing financial and other problems that the Crown of England had in that period, and just the practicalities of trying to manage that arouse all this complaint, and the fact that he has come to the throne in such a unprecedented way, that the previous king has been deposed, creates a very large target for political criticism to hone in on.
Yes, and this is where treason gets to be a lot about speech. So let's talk about that case with John. It's John Spurhawk, I think, that you said in the book was the vagabond that's wandering around. This is a really interesting case because the rumors that he's spreading are not only old, they're about related to John of Gaunt, but they're not even his rumors in the first place. So how does this come about that he is brought to trial for spreading these rumors about Henry?
Well, we don't really know. It seems that Henry had quite a lot of, there are indications early in his reign in terms of some of the commissions he gives to some of his loyal clerical officials, bishops and so on, to be keeping an eye out or watching out for this kind of dangerous talk in their communities. But whether Spearhawk is just someone who's he's come across and some village has ratted him out, essentially, or one of these kinds of a minor royal official or something has happened to hear him. But yes, his case does get picked up and snowballs into this treason proceeding, which sets a precedent, basically, for executing people as traitors for doing no more than speaking ill of the king. And, you know, he is spreading these rumours about Henry being illegitimate. Yes, the story about him not even being his father's true son, I mean, that same accusation had been made against his father back during the Good Parliament back in the sort of late 1370s. So it sort of gives a sense of how long those kinds of ideas survived and circulated within this primarily oral popular culture, the circulation of rumours and stories and tales and so on that would resurface from one generation to the next. But also among the things that he is saying is a, you know, much more pointed criticism about this is the time when Owain Glyndwr, I hope I've pronounced his name correctly, but has rebelled in Wales, seeking the independence of Wales. And this chap, John Spearhawk, is also saying that Owain Glyndwr is the true Prince of Wales, and the Pope has sent out a bull saying this. But yes, the interesting thing about Spearhawk's case is that he basically says he's heard all these things from some other woman who has told him these things. But as far as we know, she was never the woman who was the source of all these stories. They didn't even look for her. But Spearhawk is the one because he has repeated them. But the other important thing he does, is, according to the trial record, is that he doesn't just repeat these rumours. He avows them as true, which means he swears to them on his oath. And that kind of transforms verbal rumour and speech and so on into a much more significant and instrumental speech act that is then interpreted as a material act of treason that harms the body of the king. So that kind of transference from speech to deed that happens in his case and is then something that becomes more clearly cemented in law in later cases.
Yes, and this is one of the examples where it seems almost unimaginable that the tailor's wife who has told him this stuff in the first place completely gets off. She doesn't ever get prosecuted that we know of. And I think this comes back to what you were saying. So this is a good time to circle around back to what happens to the women who are involved in cases of treason, because there are a few, now that we know which part of history we're talking about, a few women try to put Richard back on the throne. What happens in those cases?
Yeah, well, see, in the cases of people like this woman who had told the story to John Spearhawk, and there are other examples too. There's another one where a man has repeated a story that he has heard from two women in Westminster who claim that they have seen Richard II, you know, some years after his death, they have seen Richard walking around. And this feeds into one of those stories that Richard is about to come back and reclaim his throne and his loyal men should be ready to support him. But what happens in those cases of women's speech is that there is this broader shift going on in the and over the 14th century, and particularly into the later 14th century, where you're starting to get a gendered distinction between disruptive or deviant types of male speech that tend to be treated much more seriously as defamation or slander. So, you know, cases that are prosecutable at law, whereas women's speech, there's a separation where women's speech is considered still socially disruptive and can be penalized in kind of informal social ways. But it's seen from the legal perspective, it's seen much more as gossip or scolding, and especially in this case, gossip. And so not as capable as of causing the same kind of material harm as male speech can. So yeah, that distinction in terms of treason, treasonous speech really has to be understood against that broader shift in the gendering of other kinds of deviant speech acts, or you get a big distinction arising between men's and women's speech. But with some of the other women who were women like, so Maud de Vere, the Countess of Oxford, she is the mother of a man called Robert de Vere, who was one of Richard's closest companions during that, the 1380s, during that period of leading up to the Merciless Parliament. And he was seen as perhaps the worst and the greatest offender amongst this group of evil counsellors that had surrounded the king and sort of removed him, even physically, but also emotionally from his true loyal, so separated him from his true counsellors and so on. Now, he was actually convicted during the Merciless Parliament, but he had by that time fled overseas and he died there. So he was dead. I think he died around 1389, 1390 or something. But his mother, so Maud de Vere, the Countess of Oxford, in 1404, 1405, she is involved in a plot to join forces with, supposedly, with the French and also with, you know, Richard, who is going to return from Scotland or sometimes Wales, depending on which version you read. But, you know, that Richard had been in hiding out of the country for some years and was about to return. So she had kind of been, appears to have been instigating a relatively sophisticated plot that involved things like having one of her men, her servants, go along the coastline in Essex and extinguish all the beacons so that the French fleet could invade under cover of darkness and things. So quite a few people get caught up in these treason proceedings, including a couple of clerics, a couple of abbots from the local area. But Maud, who seems to have been the person in charge and the person who set it all in motion, really, when you get to the trial record, she kind of is sort of taking a little bit of a back seat to the men. And then she really doesn't get any kind of formal punishment. So she has her lands confiscated for a few months and her revenues, but then they're just sort of quietly restored to her and she carries on with her day-to-day life. So whereas in these cases where you get women basically not being prosecuted for treason and sort of sidelined from the records, and the men that are involved get the more significant punishments in some cases, including execution. And there, yeah, there are a couple of other cases like that as well. It's something I started getting into when I was writing this book, but it's definitely something that I think warrants a lot more research, because at the time I wasn't able to do a kind of a systematic trawl through the records to see if there are other similar cases to this, but I think it would be a really interesting exercise to do.
Yes, because obviously there are going to be women involved in these. There's a few other ones that are sprinkled throughout, which I think are really interesting in the book, where you have someone's turned in by a prostitute who was sleeping with someone and told her the plot. So they're in there, obviously, but obviously not getting the same type of treatment when they're found guilty or just kind of, as you say, sidelined. I think it's worth talking about the actual method of execution for treason, because it's notoriously gruesome. And I think that it's hard to understand what the symbolism is behind it. So there is a lot of symbolism behind the way that someone is executed for treason. This gruesome punishment, what does it mean symbolically?
Well, it's a lot of it is because it is very much a kind of a ritualized and very public proceeding. So the drawing, we talk about it as hanging, drawing, and quartering, but the drawing came first. So drawing, the man was either tied to a hurdle, so like a little kind of sled, or just dragged bodily behind, usually behind a horse. In the case of a number of people I looked at in this book, they were dragged through the city of London. So they would be dragged through the city, out the city gates to Tyburn, and there they would be hanged. So hanging as a thief, so the idea of having, you know, stolen the love that was owed to the king. Things like the disemboweling, so the idea being that people's evil thoughts actually originated in their bowels. So this is kind of an idea that's connected to medieval medical theory, really, that your kind of liver and so on is where your evil thoughts come from. taking off the head. It's like you have tried to basically behead the body politic by killing the king or committing treason against the king, and therefore you are beheaded to sort of preserve the unity of the body politic. And then the quartering, where the body parts were sent, usually at least one part, often the head, but not always, was sent to London, so the centre of royal power, but the other body parts were sent for public display in places of significance, to either places where this person had raised their rebellions, or in the case of Henry Le Scroope, who was executed in 1415. So his family came from the Yorkshire region, and so his head was sent for display on the city walls at York. So in a society where you've still got a largely oral society, and the traitor's body really serves as a form of political propaganda, essentially to communicate that message of, if you try to divide the body politic by fomenting treason, your own body will be divided and destroyed. So, I mean, we look at it now and we think, you know, sometimes people just look at it and see, oh, this is just another example of just general medieval brutality. But there is a very clear political and social logic behind it. It's because one of the other things that happens too, in terms of the symbolism of it, when you look at very high ranking people like the Earl of Arundel, who was executed in 1397, so one of the victims of the merciless Parliament, one of the first things that happens to him is when he's brought into Parliament, to kind of into this, what is essentially a kind of kangaroo court. Although he seems to have put up a very good defence, he was probably never going to get out of there without a conviction. But, you know, one of the first things that happens is all the robes and all the, his sword is stripped away, his spurs are struck off, and his robes that signify his status as an earl are stripped off as well. So before he is tried and convicted, he is stripped of his social identity as a nobleman and as a knight. So there is that element of social humiliation as well that is part of the longer process, you know, the ritual of the trial and execution of a traitor.
Yeah, one of the things you mentioned in the book that I think is an important connection that brings it all back to masculinity before we wrap it up is that when a person speaks, it in some ways becomes embodied, which is why blasphemy is such a big issue in the Middle Ages. But you talk about trial by combat as well. I'm bringing this up because we've been talking about the last duel lately, people throwing down their gauntlets, and all of a sudden their speech becomes embodied. It becomes something that is performed as part of a masculine thing. This is a huge part of the reverse, which is taking the body apart in treason cases, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, trial by combat, I find this fascinating. It's something I'd like to do a lot more work on. So trial by combat, generally, in cases of treason, it quite often involves people of relatively high rank. So the Court of Chivalry adjudicates some of these cases, although it is a little bit jurisdiction and the boundaries between the Court of Chivalry and other kinds of legal tribunals are quite blurred. But the actual process itself, there is that one case I talk about in the book where we do have a very detailed record of the whole process that starts in the aftermath of Richard's deposition in Parliament, where people, these nobles, start flinging accusations of treason at each other. And in one case, an accusation between two lords, Lord Morley and Lord Salisbury, but that, you know, Henry basically steps in to stop it really kicking off in Parliament and said, you know, no, we're going to take this to the Court of Chivalry. But it all starts with all the lords are all throwing down their gauntlets in Parliament, you know, and waging battle against each other to prove that their accusation of treason is true. But when we go through the process in the Court of Chivalry, you know, each side writes out its, you know, the appellant writes out their charges against the other person, and they respond with their written set of charges. But the written documents are sort of just a testimony to what has been verbally stated. And, you know, the first step is the verbal accusation and the throwing of the gauntlet. But then later on, as you get into the ritual of actually deciding the combat and so on, those two written documents of these men's words that are in the first person. So it's not like an abstracted legalistic kind of document. It's a first person statement, but they're actually put into each person's glove. And then the two gauntlets or gloves are wound together as the combat is declared. And then the combat itself is really a test of whose words are true. And God will reveal this through whoever wins. So it is, in a sense, as I say in the book, in a sense, you know, trial by combat is men's words made flesh. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the combat, the loser has revealed himself to be a traitor. So normally they're just taken off and executed as a traitor pretty much right away. So yeah, it's an interesting process and ritual to really look into. And Barry, in terms of the staging that goes into it, is very elaborate. I mean, with that case, we've got the accounts of scaffolds being built for the king and the other nobles to sit and witness the combat and everything. So it's obviously quite a spectacle, as well as being a legal process.
Yes. Yeah, it's hard to imagine a treason trial being so theatrical these days, although they are very theatrical still, I think, when people are throwing around accusations. There's still so much about reputation and about speech and all of those things that still exist when it comes to treason today.
Mm. I mean, this is why it caused so many anxieties in the medieval period, because it is like you often see treason and heresy coming up in the same kind of context, because they are secret crimes. Treason exists in men's hearts. It's not something we can see on the surface. And that whole, all those anxieties about who you could really trust definitely come out through these treason proceedings, and that kind of underlying fear where you've got a political society that relies very heavily on bonds between men to function, but that those bonds are also potentially corruptible by evildoers and traitors. So that cultural sense of anxiety about who is trustworthy and who isn't, and people being false men and false knights, that comes up a lot, definitely reflects that.
Yes, it's fascinating. It's fascinating all the ways that it is still with us, and culturally how it's still with us, and how interesting it was back then. So thanks so much for coming on to talk about it. It's a fascinating topic. We can't get into everything, unfortunately, but this has been a great start. So thanks so much, Amanda, for coming on the podcast.
Oh, well, thank you for having me on. I've enjoyed it.
To find out more about Amanda's work, you can follow her on Twitter at Amanda McVitie. Her new book is Treason and Masculinity in Medieval England, Gender, Law, and Political Culture. Before we go, here's Peter from medievalist.net to tell us what's on the website. What's new, Peter?
Hey, hey. Well, Halloween is fast approaching. And when that happens, we tend to start writing about things that go bump in the night on medievalist.net. Ooh. You want all that good clickbait.
Wow, cynic. Okay, what is the good clickbait that's related to Halloween on medievalist.net?
Well, Catherine Walton has written about ghosts in medieval literature, and it features your favorite character, Gawain.
Oh, I love him.
Yeah, well, this time he's a ghost. I know.
I need to read this article.
So we have that, plus we also explain why a Scotsman is serving as a police officer in 15th century Bologna.
I like that story too. This is all good stuff.
Indeed, indeed. So we got that, little bits of news, more children's books to talk about. And yeah, we're doing well.
That's great to hear. Thanks, Peter.
Thanks.
It's that time again. Time for a new session of the Medieval Masterclass for Creators. It's a 6-week online class that I put together with some amazing experts to help people creating medieval fiction get all those little details they need without having to spend hours trying to find reliable sources on the internet. We cover everything from cooking to combat, blacksmithing to textile work, and we do it all with video demonstrations, helpful bibliographies, recipes, and writing prompts. And you can even ask me anything. The next class begins Friday, November 5th. For all the details, please visit medievalmasterclass.com. Thank you to all of our patrons on patreon.com who keep the podcast fires lit with your generous support each month. We have great stuff there, like subscriptions to Medieval Warfare Magazine and the Medieval Magazine, and our book club, as well as the exclusive maps by Tina Ross that are sent out to your inbox every month. To get in on all the action, please visit patreon.com/medievalists. For everything from traders to troubadours, follow medievalist.net on Facebook or Twitter at medievalists. You can find me, Danielle Cebulski, on social media at 5MIN Medievalist or 5 Minute Medievalist. And you can find my books at all your favorite online bookstores, where you can even pre-order the new one, How to Live Like a Monk, Medieval Wisdom for Modern Life, which will be out in hardcover, ebook, and audiobook very soon. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Guy Frog. Thanks for listening, and have yourself an amazing day.